Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is Susan Kerr, Creative Director and Product Design at Pinterest, the highly acclaimed pioneering graphic designer and influential computer iconographer who created the legendary Macintosh icons and thousands of other software icons for leading companies that have become familiar to anyone using technology today. Susan earned her MA and PhD in Fine Arts from New York University, and after a short term working as a sculptor and curator, began her graphic design career at Apple Incorporated as a screen graphics and digital font designer for the original Macintosh computer, then embarked on an independent career opening her own design firm, Susan Kerr Designs, which led to many collaborative design projects with leading technology firms such as Microsoft, IBM, Logitech, Facebook, and PayPal. She is known as the Matisse of computer icons and the woman who gave the Macintosh a smile through her intuitive, whimsical iconography, and in 2008 was named the winning medalist for the American Institute of Graphic Design, the most distinguished award in the field presented to individuals in recognition of their exceptional achievements, services, and contributions to the field of design and visual communication. The Institute recognized Susan's work for her bold and intelligent design of icons throughout her career and for the early Macintosh computers that defined the Apple user experience and set the industry standard with memorable wit and humanity. She made the graphic user interface accessible to the masses and ushered in a new generation of pixel art. Susan has also written the book Susan Kerr Icons, a collection of her favorite icons from 1983 to 2011, with explanatory notes, published in 2011. Hello, Susan, and welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Oh, thank you so much for the chance to chat with you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. You have had a remarkable career as a graphic artist and iconographer, designing thousands of legendary icons and typefaces familiar to anyone using computer and modern technology. Can you share your fascinating story of how you began your journey and became known as the Matisse of computer icons?
Thanks for asking. I was a typical kid liked art, any kind of art materials and crafts, and I kind of credit my mom for encouraging me in that area. So I graduated from college as an art major, and I didn't go to art school, but I always sought out opportunities to do graphics like posters and card designs and things, some practical applications. And thanks to a high school friend, Andy Hertzfeld, who was a system software programmer at Apple, I had the chance to join Apple and join the Macintosh group. Andy approached me since we had gone to high school and he knew that I liked art and we were neighbors in California. He showed me an early Macintosh and said he needed somebody that could create images for the screen and typefaces, and he explained that it would be analogous to drawing in squares on graph paper to make these images, and that there were just 72 squares per inch. So the resolution was pretty good, and it was black and white, and it was a lot like needlepoint. I really just kind of took to it. I tried it. He suggested I get some graph paper and just try and make some images that way, and I really enjoyed it.
Your icons were a first taste of human-computer action for most, and they were approachable, friendly, and simple. What goes through your mind when you're designing your icons, and how would you describe your approach and philosophy?
Well, I think that I was lucky in, first of all, everything that I did at Apple was collaborative, and I worked in the software group with just, I thought, such talented, thoughtful programmers, because I'm not at all trained as any kind of software engineer, but I learned by working in software a bit more about their approach. There was a strong desire for this Macintosh computer to be path-breaking, and that it was conscientiously designed to appeal to people who were non-technical and would never type in a computer command, but might be able to interact with pictures. So I tried really hard to make everything simple and relatable and non-technical. And just the constraints of that medium, making everything out of little black and white squares, kind of limited you to pressing things in a really economical way.
You've placed a premium on context and metaphor in some of your designs. Can you give us a few examples of how you chose some of your designs and the sources that you may have consulted?
I was a good example of the target audience for the computer. I designed things like the wrist was not to be a cursor to show that time was passing, but that everything was okay. I saw there are a few existing examples, and certainly Xerox PARC had screens with icons. They had a piece of paper with a folded corner. I definitely didn't invent that, but I redrew it. And they had a trash can. So I kind of pushed, but I think I took some of these basics. I certainly looked at the hourglass and thought, well, who uses an hourglass? Let's get a little more modern and have a wristwatch. And I continued to use pieces of paper for documents, but I kind of developed a symbol that had a hand with pencil doing something on the document so that the application could be a verb and the little piece of paper itself was more like a noun, things that you could drag around on your desktop. And I just tried to make a printer or a pencil or some of the icons for tools in Mac Paint, like a pouring paint can or a spray can, things that people might recognize a few salient visual details and be able to, at least have a pretty good guess at what that thing might do. Or I usually hope if someone tells you what it is once, then you remember what it is.
With the opportunities that you've had to work with such innovative tech companies, exchanging ideas with some of the brightest minds, who are some of the people that stood out for you over the years and may have informed your ideas? And what were some of the significant lessons they taught you?
Good question. I feel as if having my own design business was great in the sense that I did work for lots and lots of different companies. Some projects that were maybe a handful of images and some lot of icon projects. I think after I left Apple, I worked at Next, which was the company that Steve Jobs founded after he left Apple. And I worked for Next both as an employee and a contractor. And just because you asked, I was able to help Next develop its logo. So I thought that it would just be wonderful if we could hire a designer named Paul Rand, who's always been a tremendous graphic hero to me. And we were able to work with him. He was in his 70s. He lived in Connecticut, but he came out to San Francisco and met with everybody at Next and designed their kind of looked like a black cube with the word Next on it. He drew the letters, and because that computer was going to be shaped like a cube. I learned so much from working with him because he was very decisive. For example, when he did Next logo, he presented one thing. I would usually say, as a rule of thumb, always present a few things so you can say to the client, which of these could work for you, as opposed to, do you like it? Because you don't want to hear a no. Paul, I thought, was just a master of making images that were meaningful. He did Westinghouse and IBM's logo, and he kind of impressed on me. He was always like, don't just design something that maybe looks cool but doesn't mean something. And he always suggested that if you could combine a word and an image, that was really strong, because without spending money on advertising, you're reinforcing your message. So great to work with him. Probably another project that stands out to me that was more recent was I worked with Facebook for about 4 years on a series of virtual gifts. And this was before it was easy to upload your own graphics. So it was the opportunity to send an image, it was 64 by 64 pixels, along with a message to anybody else that was on Facebook. So for pretty close to 4 years, we would release at midnight a new gift. It was like having a virtual gift shop, cost a dollar. So my challenge was, what can you draw in 64 by 64 that will prompt someone to spend a dollar so they can send it? So I did all kinds of different jewelry and food and lava lamps and penguins. Always popular. And our most popular gift ever was a kiss mark. That probably sold the most.
With your design company, did you do a lot of limited edition prints of some of the icons that you were well known for?
I kind of have a separate business that continues. Thanks for asking. It's called careprints.com. I probably started that maybe around 2010, just making a few different sizes of some well-known Apple icons, as well as some other icons that I just designed, thinking that they have really big pixels in real life. So if you see the print from a distance, it still reads almost as if it was on a screen.
You also wrote a book in 2011 about your collection of favorite icons. And what did you enjoy most about writing this book?
A friend had the idea, you might want to make a book. And I had a wonderful writer, Steve Silberman, who used to write for Wired. And actually, he's a really versatile writer. He fairly recently wrote an interesting book about autism. But he is a good tech writer. So he wrote an essay that's at the beginning of my book, just talking about the different kind of how the Mac changed things. And I was so lucky to be able to work at this transition from screens with, green glowing characters to introduction of more graphics on a screen and image-based computing. So in my book, it was 2011, so TikTok. It's been a few years, but I just include illustrations of icons from all kinds of different jobs, from Apple onward. Some of them low resolution, very pixelated, and some of them created in Illustrator, more like splines, vector images that have a higher resolution, more like a Facebook GIF.
If you were to advise young artists and graphic designers on how they might become involved in computer graphics and design now and use their artistic talents most creatively, what might you suggest they start with or get involved in?
Well, I love, just today I had breakfast with a recent grad. I enjoy chatting with people in this field. I mean, it's very different now because when I started shortly after the earth cooled, there weren't really university programs in graphical user interface design. Very different now, more tools. To me, it is not essential to study computer user interface design per se, but I love to hire people who have experience thinking about solving visual communication problems. That's what it boils down to. I think a good way to get experience is to volunteer your services for doing posters and icons and any kind of digital work for worthwhile causes, just to build up your portfolio. It's interesting now that really anybody can develop a website or put your work on Dribbble and get your work out there. And it's so much easier to see other applications and things people have designed and even try your hand at how you would do it if you were going to do something over to have portfolio work.
Are you working on any special projects or books that you'd like to tell us about?
Well, for the last 4 years, I've worked at Pinterest, and Pinterest is kind of thinks of itself as the home of inspiration. And I like Pinterest very much because I just love collecting and saving different images. I feel as if inspiration is everywhere. Neon signs and the beach and needlework and petroglyphs from a few thousand years ago. And Pinterest is sometimes a good tool for collecting all this kind of info so that you have it. I've been working a lot on how Pinterest might use the pushpin more significantly as a metaphor. It's always been on the save button, and I think it's a great symbol for saying, I want to save this because it's a little special. Just the way in real life you use a pushpin to just tack something up on a wall that you don't want to forget or you want to think about or you want to look at. And I've done projects here from icons and cursors to some environmental art. I've been making in our buildings 9-foot-tall pins made out of things. I did one where it doesn't have an outline, but I filled it with probably about 250 red objects. And I just finished one where I made a pin out of clocks. They're kind of like murals, but these installations are metaphors for Pinterest boards.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for speaking with us and taking the time to share your insight and story with us. It's been a pleasure having you on our show, and best of luck in your upcoming projects.
Thank you so, so much. And again, thanks for your kindness in inquiring. Take care.
You
Bye.
Too. Thank you. That was Susan Kerr, graphic designer and computer iconographer, speaking with us from San Francisco. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Our guest this evening is Henning Meyer Jansen, a highly accomplished photographer involved in a wide range of landscape, architectural, corporate, and portrait photographic projects for an extensive client list of major corporations, associations, advertising and PR firms, magazines, publishing houses, and more, including such companies as Lufthansa, Audi, ThyssenKrupp, Adidas, and Deutsche Telekom. Henning graduated with distinction in communication design, specializing in photography from Folkwang University in Essen, Germany. He has won numerous awards, such as the Kodak Youth Prize, the European Architectural Photography Prize, which is the most prestigious global award of its kind. He has been involved in a wide range of exhibitions, and his works may be found in the Ruhr Museum and Rheinisches Industrial Museum in Rhineland-West Germany. Henning is a member of the German Photographic Academy and Freelens. His practice involves research, collaborative film production and publications, digital image processing, comprehensive consultation, post-production services, and he also teaches in the art program at the University of Berlin. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You have an incredible portfolio and a remarkable eye for capturing a story in the moment, innovatively using elements to create the most dynamic compositions for a wide variety of landscape, architectural, corporate, and portrait photographic projects. Can you tell us about some of them?
So the most important thing that holds all my work together is about the attitude. That's a common trait in all my stories. So like a mind work kind of thing, I dig into a subject and then try to understand everything before starting to transform my ideas into a point of view. And that led me to the pictures. And even though there's a difference between something like art or commercial work, for me that attitude to the subject is the most important point of everything in a photo story. So the way the picture is composed and the technical approach and all this follows this attitude.
You've illustrated the highly acclaimed book Under the Open Sky about the Emscher Landscape Park. Would you like to tell us about this project and what you found most rewarding about your involvement in illustrating this book?
Yeah, so with this Under the Open Sky, the idea was to make a book about these landscape art in the Ruhr area. And for an example, these are mining heaps, something like 50 meters high. And on top, there's a Richard Serra steel sculpture that's 15 meter high. And so my customer would like to get aerial photography from me. In that moment, I realized the whole book with aerial photography, it sounds a little bit boring because it's too far away and it's interesting, but it's not emotional. So I suggested to use an aerial platform to get something that's 20 meters high. So you have a point of view like a bridge, but it's for the observer. You're just more into the picture like landscape painting. And so that's the way I realized that project. So this high of 20 meters allows me to have a picture of this landscape, the context, and the art in the landscape.
When did your interest in photography begin, and who or what may have inspired your decision to follow a career in photography?
It starts in my early 20s when I wanted to change the world to be a better place, like maybe everyone in his early 20s. But people get easily bored by that, I think. So pictures, however, caught the observer's emotion much faster than written words. So this is why I got interested in photography, to get this emotional part. When I started studying photography in Essen, I was inspired by some American photographers like William Eggleston. So maybe you know this picture of him with a red painted wall and a white under the light bulb hanging from the top, and Jill Sternfield did really magic pictures from the United States, like the fireman buying pumpkins at a farm market while the farmhouse is burning just behind him. And so that led me to some European photographers like Paul Graham, who took a photo book like New Europe. It was in the end of the 80s when there was a lot of change in Europe. And there's one picture I was really interested in. It's gray house front with a wide window frame taken in the night, and the white crosses of the window frame evoke an association of a military cemetery. So it's this change. It looks like something totally different than it's just on the picture. And I was interested in Volker Heinz, who realized an artist book, Ahnung. Ahnung is a German word, it's maybe like clue, something like that. So he realized really dark pictures, and there's no text in the book. All pictures are taken in East Berlin just in the year before the wall came down. And it starts with a picture of a rusty door, which is a door of the Secret Service jail. So all these pictures or picture stories have their own very special way to describe the world or deal with circumstances, history, or emotions. And that what inspires me to think about how visual storytelling could work and how to transform my ideas to icons. I haven't had a hero, something like that, even studying at Volker Heinze years later at the university.
You did graduate distinction in the visual communications program at Folkbang University and were involved in many innovative projects at the time during your program and after you graduated. Can you tell us about the program and what may have been most beneficial in preparing you for your career?
So I think that there were many things, but there are two little things just in the beginning. So in the first year, we had to go through black and white, but there was just only, it was just a question from Inger Oswald, the teacher, after one student had shown really beautiful exotic pictures from South America. She was just asking, do you really believe that elephants are more interesting than cows? Even though there were no elephants on the picture, but that was just an eye-opener for me as a photographer, that I always have this question in mind to remind me not to be blinded by exotic subjects and focus on interesting pictures. And in the second year, once we had to take pictures of an important political event, a friend of mine asked the teacher, Angela Neuke, for a course participation to apply for a permit to enter the event. So the professor's answer was, I think he did not understand the task, so she did not help us to get in. That was part of our job. So in my opinion, both of those aspects, the visual and the task, are really important for being a photographer. So I learned that there's no option to stop only because the door seems to be closed. And on the other hand, I always ask myself if the picture I've just taken is a good one, even if it's just showing a cow or something stupid like that.
So considering your ideas of how you'd like to be telling a story, does that come into play, for example, an industrial company? What do you see when you walk into an industrial plant that's in operation, and how does this translate into your visual story?
If I walk into a company, something like a commercial work, then I'm thinking about how to translate it, how to make connections, maybe if they have some history in this place. So I'm really interested in connecting it to the history. If it's possible, I look to the old pictures, reading about the history. So just make some investigation to build my attitude to the subject. Then when I went in, I just look around where there's some connection to it. So with ThyssenKrupp, it was just really three kind of documentation of building their new company's building. But it was really historical play. So there were some pictures with the oldest building where all starts with a company, and then just going over to the newer buildings they are just building at the moment.
You also have a very extensive client list of major corporations, associations, magazines, publishing houses, and more. How did you build such a client list?
It starts with working for magazines while I was studying, and then it's something like from mouth to mouth, so it's growing a little bit, and especially with this Under the Open Sky. When this project was finished, I went to the head of photography at the Ruhr Museum at the World Heritage at Solferhein. So my idea was to sell her some pictures. She told me that she has no budget for that, and she brought me to the next project. She had the idea that my kind of photography would perfectly fit for the changing landscape when they transform the River Amsha from a swag back to a river.
So it's good timing then as well.
Yeah, sometimes you have to be lucky.
You also composed an intriguing photo essay about the Berlin Palace, the Emperor's New Clothes, with construction site photography in a series of photographs that tell a story of place and history. Can you tell us how you approached this design assignment and how your style succeeds in making the story more comprehensible for the viewer?
Yes, so the title of it, with this Emperor's New Clothes, is from the fairy tale of Hans Christian Andersen, an old story about a king, his clothes, and how he would like to be seen. So at the end, the king is naked because no one was able to tell him that there's no clothes he's wearing, it's just nothing. So that really fits to me to the new imitation of a castle in the center of Berlin. Because originally the castle was built around 1700 for the German king, and then it was burned in the Second World War. And in 1950, the building was torn down to replace by Palast der Republik. It's where the Eastern German government was based. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, they decided to rebuild the castle. So So for me, this history feels a little bit similar to what happened to churches when the religion changed. So new churches are built on the old ones just to overwrite history. So that's why I try to show the context of rebuilding historical monuments in the center of Berlin. I just want to draw attention to make everybody judge on their own. So in my idea, it was just to get an overview. So I have this building in the center of Berlin with all these towers and all these iconic buildings around. So I asked to stood on top of a roof. So I found my spot where the new building is just fitting in this ensemble of all the other buildings in Berlin.
You've also continued to be involved in academics and have taught at the University of Berlin. What did you find most inspiring and rewarding about teaching?
Yes, for me, it's fitting together to my main point, I think, because to show young people that they have to investigate the world and themselves to find their attitude to a subject, for me, it's so important because I think nowadays cameras are so good that everyone can take technically correct pictures. So for me, the goal is to take pictures that will get the observer involved, to make emotional pictures, not technically correct pictures. So I had this interesting experience while teaching. One of my students was complained about the topic I gave them. So my idea was to send them to the Berlin Wall Memorial to take pictures of it. But one guy came back and said he's totally bored about the subject. And I told him that I do not agree with him, but okay, that's his opinion. But I will not accept if he was making boring pictures. So his job is to transform his opinion into interesting pictures. So even if he's bored or he's thinking that my idea was not the best one, he has to show this to me. I think it's something about reading pictures and writing pictures. So we are so used to letters, but we're not that used to deal with pictures. And I think that's the point I'm interested in.
You did a science and art video installation, Anthropolis, with a white back at the Folkfang Museum in Essen. Can you tell us about the idea behind this and the innovative effects and video production you were able to incorporate?
The idea was to realize it was about an art in public space. So I was interested in the architecture of the museum. So now the building is torn down and rebuilt. But at that time, they had really huge windows to the main road in the city of Essen. But the entrance was on the other side. So my idea was to use these windows to show my film so that you can see it from outside the museum, mainly by people got stuck in traffic jam. So it's more for the people outside the museum than inside. So I was thinking about how people are moving in the city, and that's why I came to the idea of thermal imaging camera producing a film about moving ants. In the film, they just look like dots. They are moving abstractly, but on a natural way. So I think you really can see that it origins from nature, not just a digital subject that's made on a computer, because they have these natural movement. And that's what I want to show just into the city, not from the museum side, from the outer side.
Do you have any new projects coming up that you'd like to share with us?
I'm thinking about the project I would like to continue. It's about Spielfeld. So Spielfeld is a small town, and the name is playing field or playground. And it's a town on the Slovenian-Austrian border where all these refugees entered the European Union in 2015. And so it's a place where the first fence to prevent such events was built. However, it's a really beautiful landscape. There are a lot of winemakers. They did not support the idea of a fence. So this fence has a lot of gap where the winemakers doesn't allow to make a fence through their wine gardens. I took landscape overview pictures about this beautiful landscape with traditional wineries and about refugees, winery, and yeah, maybe some kind of future of Europe. And I think there are many really interesting places that I would like to go, especially at this area where the border of the Cold War, they just teared down the border and now they rebuild it against refugees.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for taking the time to share your insight and stories with us. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I wish you continued success.
Well, thank you for the time and for the invitation, and it was just a pleasure to talk to you about my photography work. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That was Henning Mary Jensen, highly renowned photographer, speaking with us from Berlin. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.